this guy on here. All right. So today is November 17th, Thursday, November 17th, at about 1 o'clock, and I'm speaking with Gregory Piazza. Is Greg something?
Is better.
Okay, great. Speaking with Greg here in Ferndale. Beautiful sunny day, even though it's November.
Yes.
So, all right. I guess what I'd like to do is just basically have kind of a conversation, you know, nothing too intense. I don't want to have a firm script or anything, you know. But I just, first off, if you wouldn't mind, just if I can ask, just kind of your background, where you're from originally.
Originally, I'm from Madison, Wisconsin.
Madison, Wisconsin.
I was born there April 16th, 1951.
Uh-huh.
In Janesville, where Paul Ryan and the late Dr. Adam Annie, who was president of Wayne State, were both born in Janesville, which is a suburb of Madison, where my mother lives.
Oh, okay.
Actually. I went to parochial undergraduate elementary school.
Okay.
And then went to a very good, brand new high school, Madison Memorial. It was specifically built, this was in the 1960s, specifically built to be more like a college campus was their outlook. And we had block scheduling. And, you know, you'd have an hour lecture and then you'd have a 20-minute discussion group. And this was new. This was new stuff. And it was one of the better schools.
Did you like it?
Yes. Yeah. It's changed a lot since then, though. When I go back, it's very strange. Anyway, I had Madison in the 60s had a program called the Stagecoach. And what it was, Madison is built on the City Beautiful Plan, thanks to a man named John Nolan. And what that is that was an idea, a way of constructing cities that came about in the late 19th century, to the early 20th. And it tied in with things like the Arts and Crafts Movement and the Art Nouveau. And one of its ideas was that people needed adequate recreation.
Mm-hmm.
So every place in Madison is within 10 minutes or so of a park or a picnic ground or a beach. Or Madison has four lakes. It's built around with an isthmus between Monona and Monona Lakes.
I didn't know that.
And the lake is ringed with parkland, primarily, rather than commercial development. And what the Stagecoach outreach program was, is they would do fairy tales, dramatizations of fairy tales. And we would come in, the players, we were in an old Jeep. It had been outfitted for us, and pulling a wagon. And we'd come into a park and we'd jump out of the Jeep and we'd sing as we set up the stage. You know, and people would get the little kids, adults, all over. And we did, I played the Beast in Beauty and the Beast. And it was Hansel and Gretel. We would go to four or five parks a day.
Oh, wow.
There were that many parks over the course of a summer. And then at the end of the summer, we would have a stage play. We did Augustine Daly's Under the Gaslight, which was the first melodrama, first play of any kind, but first melodrama to use the conceit where somebody got tied to the railroad tracks. Only in this case, it wasn't the heroine. It was one-armed Civil War soldier.
Interesting.
You know, he was fighting the villain, and he got tied to the railroad tracks, and she had to chop her way out of the hut where she was captive, and then she ran and untied him before the train went by. Train, which originally consisted of two flats with two guys behind it, running along like that. Only opening night of Italian 1867, one of the guys tripped and the flat fell.
Oh no!
Anyway, so the women who were running it said, "You know, you make a good character actor." And there's a semi-professional program for undergrads at Wayne State University in Detroit. Why don't you look into it? So I did, and got accepted into the BFA program. And then I got a job working in the costuming shop at the Hillbury. In the days when it was in the basement, behind what was then the Studio Theater, which if you saw that space, you'd never imagine that we could get anything out of there, but we had tons of stuff. Yeah. So I was exposed to a lot of people who were extremely good at what they were doing. And this was, I came to Detroit in August of 1969. And at that time, the Hillbilly, I think, was in its golden age.
And, nice.
And I learned a lot. Unfortunately, did not get very far in the program because I'm not that good an actor, evidently. Oh. So I stayed on and got a bachelor's in speech. Graduated in 73.
Okay.
And between then and now, I've done a lot of different stuff.
Yeah.
A lot of stuff.
That's cool.
In 73, 74, I moved into the Palmer Park Apartments District,
mm-hmm.
known simply as The Park
okay.
to most of us. And it stayed there till 91, when the city just got too bad.
Yeah.
People really started leaving.
Mm. Was that when, like, the crime was really bad?
Stress, save our streets.
Mm-hmm.
And they were rogue cops who would go around and beat up black guys. And it was ridiculous. It really was. Anyway,
yeah.
The park was, Horace Greeley said, "Go west, young man." And if he was speaking to a gay man of that era, it was, "Go to Palmer Park, young man."
Yeah.
Because if you had the slightest bit of money, you went there. You wanted quality apartments. You wanted a delightful atmosphere. You wanted entertainment. We had it. There were eight bars, either within walking distance or with a short drive to 7 Mile from
wow.
6 Mile. And they were all distinct. They were all different.
Mm-hmm.
And it really was the heart of the gay community.
Interesting. Was that a dramatic difference than Madison, for instance? Like when
oh, yes.
Yeah.
Intensely different.
Interesting.
Intensely. Madison, did, at that time, at least, did not have a gay bar.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Well,
and
I
don't
yeah.
think he does now, either.
Hmm.
It's, if you want to picture Madison, picture Ann Arbor
mm-hmm.
with four lakes in the state capitol.
Okay.
It's the atmosphere is virtually the same. They look alike, they feel the same to me. So whenever I go to Ann Arbor, it's like going home.
That's interesting. Yeah. I haven't been to Madison, but I used to live in Ann Arbor. So, yeah, I can kind of picture a bit of that then. Yeah, so the Palmer Park area, or the park, is the center of the gay community back then?
Yes.
In the
everybody,
70s?
Just about everybody who was gay had some attachment to the park. Either you lived there, your ex-boyfriend lived there, his best friend, your third cousin who was gay, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it had the... It was difficult to get into an apartment in the park.
Mm.
How I landed, I still can't figure out because I went door to door.
Really?
Which is considered something you don't do. But for some reason, maybe it's fate, I don't know. And then once I got in there, I got digging into the history of the place, and
mm-hmm.
that just took off. And the historic
right.
landmark district now. And I've written a book on the architectural history,
mm-hmm.
and then I've just finished a biography of Senator Palmer, who owned all the land.
Oh, neat.
He owned over 600 acres.
So what inspired you to write the books?
Well,
the
architectural history, I took a look at that, and even now, you took a look at those buildings,
mm-hmm.
and it's just exquisite design. And when you take, we used to do tours every year,
mm-hmm.
Until it really got to be too much. And there was an art fair originally when I moved in the neighborhood. We set up an art fair. We had a very active residence group, which was unusual in that it included landlords. And we did a huge fair, and then I did tours, and I, after many years, I thought, you know, I've amassed all this information.
Mm-hmm.
So a couple of years ago, I decided to put it into a book, and ran into Dan Austin, and he said, "Let me introduce you to Arcadia Press."
Mm-hmm.
They agreed to publish it.
That's great.
It came out a couple years ago. Hasn't done very well.
No.
And then I wrote a biography of Senator Palmer, which is probably going to be out in the spring with a different publisher. So I'm not sure when it's going to be out. But anyway, you look at the quality of the workmanship in those buildings, and the owners really didn't care if you were gay. You know, they didn't particularly, most of them wanted somebody who was real flamboyant. But they got a tenant who was stable, good job, money to pay the rent, was not only willing to keep the apartments in good shape, sometimes would make a deal where for a cut in their rent for a couple months they put in a top of the range stove paid for by the tenant. And it was, that happened, the apartments got painted every time somebody moved. So it was freshly painted, wood floors were refinished, you had hardwood floors. And the rents at the time were, looking back on them now, I mean, two-bedroom apartment, single bath was maybe $250 a month.
Wow.
You know, which was considered a little more high-end in those days.
Sure. Yeah, you know, now that doesn't sound like a lot, but
back in the 70s,
that's quite a bit.
So when you walk around the neighborhood looking at the architecture, which we come to realize with the book, is that we start with 1924. It was the first apartment building designed by a firm called Widmeyer and Gay. And as you walk around the neighborhood with the book as a guide, you have an example of every period in their corporate life from the 1920s to when they split in 1955.
Interesting.
And you can follow them right around the neighborhood and see them adapt and change. And there are, you may, there aren't a lot of them left anymore. The what's called Moorish Revival.
Okay.
It's elaborate arching. And it's based on the Alhambra in Spain. In fact, there's a place on Woodward in Highland Park. There's one building that takes up a whole block. That was, it's right below Davison.
Okay. Gotcha.
And they took over the whole block. They had underground parking. They had magnificent apartments. It's a burned out shell now, but somebody may try and save it.
Yeah.
Because it's so unique.
That's cool.
And the park has, quickly was becoming some of the only examples of some of these architects' work. You know, because the other parts of the city have gone down so far.
Yeah, that's really too bad how a lot of really beautiful buildings have kind of crumbled over the
years. Well, it's always the car maker's mentality. You know, that every year you got a new car. And you really didn't care for the old. Though Ford was setting up his museum was a little more ahead of the, you know, the curve on that one.
True.
So each of the bars was distinctive. And they, the fun started Thursday night and didn't stop till dawn on Monday. It's
always a party, huh?
Always a party somewhere.
Yeah.
Always a party somewhere. And of course, we were young. We were in our 20s, early 30s. Highly educated people. There were a lot of lawyers for some reason. A healthy crop of teachers.
Interesting.
And of course, hairdressers. You had to have the hairdressers. There were a couple buildings that were efficiencies, all efficiencies. One of them was at 3rd and Merton, which is unfortunately gone now. And it was, the since there were efficiencies, the rents were even lower. They were like $150 a month.
Wow.
For an efficiency apartment. So a lot of the drag queens moved in. Because, like I said, the owners didn't care as long as you were maintaining them. Not having wild parties.
Sure.
And since most of them were referrals, you knew what you were getting. And they would give the big drag shows, which were there at Bookies, which is gone now. Which is a little west of the gas station.
Okay.
That side, McNichols and 3rd.
Gotcha.
So it was an easy walk for them right from that building.
That's convenient.
So you have fine drag entertainment. You had dancing at Menjo's. Mm-hmm. There's a place in the same building as Menjo's called the Glass House.
Mm-hmm.
After many different names, it became the Glass House. And that was kind of like your neighborhood bar sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you had 7 Mile, you had the Outlaw, which was a bite leather and cowboy bar. And you had Heaven, which was young guys in their sugar daddies, and the E-Ramp, which was a little tougher leather place.
Mm-hmm.
You were by car, you could get anywhere.
Interesting.
In a fairly short amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
So it had everything we needed.
That's neat. Did you have a favorite of those places? Favorite bar? Or
I usually hung out either at the Glass House.
Okay.
Before I really got involved in Levi and Leather clubs. And then we met at the Interchange, which became the Eagle.
Okay.
It's at Holden and Trumbull, just south of Henry Ford Hospital.
Okay.
In fact, they were going to buy the land that it sits on, but they decided not to. And it's a bar now. It's a straight bar. I can't remember what the name of it is.
Okay.
But it's still there.
And Menjo's is still there, right?
Menjo's is still there, and they're going to reopen the part that was the Glass House.
Oh, okay. Interesting. So what was your favorite aspect of living in the neighborhood? Just the community, or
I think it was the freedom to be me.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't have to lie to your neighbors.
Mm. Yeah.
And that you could let your hair down, and we did more coffee clutching throughout the building. I mean, and you know, my best friend lived on the fourth floor, I lived on the third floor at 980 Whitmore.
Mm-hmm.
And we were constantly going back and forth. You know, and two more friends lived on the third floor on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was one in the building across the street, and the building down the block, there were two more. So if you wanted just to get together on a Sunday,
mm-hmm.
you know, it wasn't difficult.
That's nice.
They used to say, you know, it's 1 o'clock in Palmer Park on a Sunday afternoon because all the gays are running around with their chafing dishes going to brunch.
Sounds like a good time.
And yeah. It was. It was delightful. And I remember some friends had a party for, I think it was New Year's Eve. They lived at 660 Whitmore. And a friend of theirs across the hall had a party in. We were carrying on when we were carrying on. But Carl opened the door to his apartment and he said, come and join me.
Mm-hmm.
We walked in. He had this very elegant apartment. He was the old portraits of the ancestors on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
A Kanabe piano, which was an antique then, and this was in the 1970s.
Oh, wow.
So the people you met were unique.
Mm-hmm.
They were very different. If you look, a good example of that is the religious institutions.
Mm.
There are 5 religious institutions.
Really?
There's a little church that's like Protestant, Methodist, Episcopal.
Mm-hmm.
They're on 6 Mile near Second.
Okay.
Then there's the White Spire Church, which was the 5th Church of Christ Scientist.
Mm.
Across the street is Detroit Unity. Across the street from that was the Greek Orthodox. It's a Mormon church now.
Really?
Isn't that strange?
Yeah, that's kind of surprising.
And then
on
the other end
of
the park, on the west end, you had Temple Israel.
Okay.
So what's unique about that is that normally you get churches in subdivisions, but they're usually on major streets.
Mm-hmm.
These 5 were right in the middle. 3 of them especially are right in the center of the community.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So, and what was great was the celebration of the holidays. Because I could sit in my apartment. I lived across, first apartment was across the street from the Greek Orthodox. And of course, their Christmas is at a different time. Their Easter is at a different time.
Mm-hmm.
So for Easter, I could open my apartment windows because it was warm enough. And I could hear them processing around the church and singing and the incense. And then when I lived at the other end of the park, the High Holy Days at the synagogue. And hear the shofar blowing.
Hmm.
People coming and going in there.
That's neat. You get, it seems like kind of an eclectic mix.
Very. I've often told people, and I say in the book, if you want to know what Paul McCracken was like in that era, read Armistead Maupin's Tales of the City. Mm-hmm. He's talking about San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the same place.
Interesting.
His major characters could have fit right in Palmer Park without a hitch.
Might have to take a look at that. Sounds. So, do you? I guess you lived there for about 20 years, then,
yeah.
Right? For up till 1991.
Yeah.
What changes did you see during that time?
I turned around and people were gone.
Yeah.
And I thought, where are they going? They were getting down, a friend's car was firebombed.
Oh, man.
And it turned out, they got the guy because it was the wrong car. He went to firebomb the car behind him,
mm-hmm.
and when he threw the Molotov cocktail, which I heard crash on the pavement, and
yikes.
Looked out to see Richard's car going up in flames, I thought, people are gone, it's time to go. And I knew what was happening in the rest of Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
And the decline was really beginning. It was accelerating. And for years, I stayed away from the park.
Yeah.
I didn't go there. I didn't want to see the wreckage.
Sure.
You know? But when I did go back, which was a few years ago, when they set up the group that's now promoting the public park,
mm-hmm.
Friends of Palmer Park, I was amazed that it survived.
Yeah.
With very little loss.
That's
good. They've only lost three buildings.
Wow.
Three, maybe four, and they've got three more that are abandoned.
Hmm.
But then you consider that originally, depending on how you counted, there was like 75 buildings.
Oh, wow.
So to lose that few is something. And part of that is because the three major owners who are left have been there for so long.
Hmm.
I mean, John Seco is managing buildings his parents bought in the 1950s.
Oh, wow.
And Jerry Pecchia has been there since the 1970s. And the McKinos have come in and just done a phenomenal job.
Yeah.
They'll buy a building, they'll preserve the exterior detail, completely gut the interior and build it new. So you've got a new frame within this, and they restored architectural detail, which I never thought anybody was going to do.
Right? That's a lot of work.
And that's a lot of expense.
Yeah, that too, definitely.
But they've done a phenomenal job.
That's
kept the neighborhood together while we wait for the prosperity to come from the south.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest problem there is Highland Park.
Yeah, that seems to be a pretty rough city, I guess.
It's so sad.
Yeah.
The business district along 6 Mile is just crap.
Yeah.
Someone really needs to come in. And then someone really needs to come in and just level those first three blocks of the buildings parallel to 6 Mile.
Mm-hmm.
Between Woodward and 6 and Hamilton and 6.
Mm. That seems like it would help if they did. But.
Well, that was a fairly decent residential neighborhood.
Yeah.
In my day.
Hmm.
But it's surely gone to crap now.
Yeah. Do you get back down there often now? Or?
A little more often, yeah. We reconstituted some of the tours a couple years ago.
Nice.
And the city is now putting a considerable amount of money in restoring the log cabin, which was a real surprise to me after my dealings with the city back in my day.
So what is the log cabin?
The log cabin was the summer home of Senator and Mrs. Palmer.
Okay.
And it still stands. And for many, many years, they donated it in 1895. And for many years, it was a museum because it was full of the Palmer treasures.
Mm-hmm.
He was a pack rat. Honest to God, he was a pack rat.
Really?
And then in the 1970s, the furniture and other artifacts were removed to Fort Wayne.
Hmm.
And I suspect they'll go back into the cabin at some point, since the city's taking a renewed interest.
Mm-hmm.
But this group has been around to really lobby for the cabin and restoring the cabin.
That's cool.
And he was an interesting character. He was a state senator. He was U.S. senator.
Mm-hmm.
He was on envoy to Spain and president of the Columbian Exposition or the Chicago World's Fair,
oh, wow,
as it's called. He gave the first speech in the U.S. Senate on suffrage for women in 1885.
Wow.
And he was
that's pretty
Susan
early.
B. Anthony was in attendance.
Oh, wow.
That night.
Yeah. That's
and the biography has a letter. It probably was a bad boy to do this. He had a letter, really bitchy letter from Susan B. Anthony to them looking
really?
For money. Don't tell me you don't have it. I know you do. Don't tell me too many people have asked you.
She's rather forceful, huh?
She wanted $500 from each of them.
Oh.
This was the 1890s.
That's a lot of money.
And when they got some money from both of their estates.
Huh.
He died in 1913 with an estate value of $4.5 million. She died in 1916 with an estate of $6 million. And she founded what is now the Skillman Palmer.
Okay.
The center down there.
Man.
Yeah. Merrill Palmer Center. Skillman Merrill Palmer Center.
Interesting. That's a lot of money. Even now.
Yeah.
I'd be happy with that.
That's a chunk of change.
Right. Man. So he never lived to see women's suffrage come into into being then.
Neither did Susan B. Anthony.
No, that's true. Huh. That's too bad. Huh. So I guess how did the LGBT community in Palmer Park affect the rest of the city, do you think?
I think as an example of how a community runs and how it sticks together.
Yeah. That's good.
I mean, you couldn't be a bigot and live very successfully in the park.
Yeah.
You know, you knew someone belonged in the neighborhood. You know, whether we were all sitting out on our porches or walking around, you knew people. You would go other places. I went to Chicago and Kansas City and New York.
Mm-hmm.
And you would see people and you'd know each other. You didn't know each other's name, but you knew you lived at 660 Whitmore.
Sure.
And I lived at 700, or I lived at 225. And there was kind of a hierarchy, in a way, by what building you lived in.
Okay.
660 Whitmore was an exclusive building. 980 Whitmore was famous for other things. It's a building that had five choir directors living in there with five pianos in it.
Oh, wow.
Spinet. And there were unique buildings like 999, which is all cast concrete. Townhouse apartments stacked on top of each other.
Mm-hmm.
So it was either by unique architecture or by the cost of living there. And you had in most buildings, one apartment that was done to the owner's taste, and that would be his private pad. So it's a cachet if you could say, I live in the original owner's apartment.
Ooh.
So that was, that was a big deal. Top of the grade. Appliances, special finishes, special outlets and fittings, and one of them had a mural on the wall in the dining room.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So with how tight-knit the community was back in the park, you say a lot of people moved out and I'm assuming spread out to other areas. Did the community kind of dissolve's not right,
but
you know, kind of
dissolve is the word.
Yeah.
There's no center to it. Ferndale is kind of taken over.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. Because at first people just moved. They didn't have any place to move.
Sure.
Then a few years ago they started moving here.
Hmm.
And now it's become the second we call it the second incarnation of Palmer Park.
Nice.
It won't ever quite be that way again because you won't have people who develop those buildings and stay with them for so long.
Mm-hmm.
There is a building, 225 Merton, that was held by the owner's family from the day it was built in 1929 till they sold it, which was about, I think it was 2005, I think.
Oh, wow.
We stayed in the same family all that time.
That's almost 80 years. That's, yeah. Huh. It seems like you don't see that much anymore anywhere.
No, the values are different.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we didn't just live in the park. You had a certain lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
You had a certain way you carried yourself.
Sure.
And like I said, you knew people. You knew who belonged and who didn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hmm. So how long have you lived in Ferndale?
Since, this would be 21 years.
Okay. So, like, right after you moved out of the park, did you come up here then?
No, I came up here in 95.
Oh, okay, so there was a little time in between.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
I lived on those apartments on I-75 and 14.
Yeah.
Colonials along there. I lived in one of those.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. So not too far. That'd be Madison Heights, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was working in Pontiac, so.
Okay. Yeah. So that's
not too bad.
Fairly close.
Yeah.
Hmm. Interesting. Ferndale. I'll have been here 3 years now. It's a fun community. I like. It seems kind of the way you're describing. You know, there's the little bars everywhere, and everyone's kind of got their, a little bit of variety. Which is, it's kind of
some
nice.
New restaurant opening every time you turn around.
Right? Yeah, yeah. It's amazing.
Please, folks.
It's kind of nice, though.
It is. The cachet that was the park will never be recreated.
Sure.
Because we were there in our village, and we could be us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we shared the same values. We bought the same closet doors.
Sure.
The gay people today have so much freedom. It's amazing.
Yeah.
It is totally amazing.
Yeah, things seem to have changed a lot, even over the past 10, 15 years with that. Actually, that kind of brings up a question. When you first came out, was there, like, some sort of support system you had, is there something you wish you would have had that seems like people have now?
I've always said that we older guys should set up a school so that you younger guys will know the ropes.
Right.
Because as I explained it to somebody, it was really like the atmosphere of the salon in France, in that you'd go to a party in this beautiful apartment building with all these people who were mostly college educated, with at least a bachelor's. And you had this group that talked about what they had just seen on Broadway in their annual trip to New York. And this group that talked sports, this group that talked politics. And politics were usually liberal, of course. But you had all these, and you as a young person, I graduated in 73, so I was 22.
Mm-hmm.
And you soaked up all this culture.
Sure.
And somehow it was just taken for granted that you would soak up all this culture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you would have these treks to New York or Chicago or wherever it was. Even with the tough S&M guys, you'd see them out of town, and you'd see, you're wearing a suit now, but I've seen you in pure leather.
Yeah. Interesting.
So you learned a lot. You learned how to live.
Mm-hmm.
And it was expected. A certain standard of behavior was expected.
Sure.
And that was community pressure.
Mm-hmm.
You know? There was no one organization that took care of it. And I really, in some ways, think there should be.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah, I mean, that makes some sense to me.
That's why projects like this and projects like Tim Retzloff's work on Gay Detroit are so valuable.
Mm-hmm.
Because
yeah,
the younger generation just doesn't know. Hmm. And you don't have the bar structure.
True.
That you did then.
Mm-hmm.
And the bars were pretty much packed most of the time Sunday afternoons. We got at Tiffany's. Around Woodward there across from the park.
Yeah.
It's around where La Dolce Vita.
Okay.
Yes.
Sure.
And you had Ted's, which is now a marijuana clinic, up a few blocks. And where's Dutch Grill Donuts.
Oh, yeah.
And you had Tiffany's there on Woodward. And all the bars had, on Sunday, but most of the bars would have brunch.
Mm-hmm.
And every holiday, they had big holiday dinners.
Mm.
And especially for Christmas, when if you weren't going home,
mm-hmm.
it was really, really a nice service. And there was the backstage restaurant. There's a laundromat there now.
Huh.
So you had these welcoming places.
Mm-hmm.
I've often said about Ted's, you go in after the bars, and sitting at the counter you'd have a gay male prostitute, a drag queen, a cop, a female, real female prostitute, and some guy from the suburbs who's drunk on his ass. You know? But that's what all these people mixed.
Yeah.
That was the wonderful thing about the place. You could bring all these characters together.
Yeah.
And not to say that it wasn't without its strife, it had its problems. But
sure.
Overall, it was totally unique like that. And you had a bar for every taste
mm-hmm.
in the city.
Huh.
And it was, there ought to be something, there ought to be some place where young gay men can go
mm-hmm.
and learn about their history.
Yeah.
I don't know if affirmation should do that or...
I don't know. That seems like it would be a good goal, though, to have something like that. It's another project to do.
Well, and I think because so many of us are dying off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when AIDS hit...
Oh, yeah.
You know, your generation's not had the experience of watching friends.
Mm.
And in those days, it was so fast.
Right.
You didn't have the drugs that you have now.
Yeah, things have changed a lot with that mm. treatment. I actually used to volunteer at the Lansing Area AIDS Network
mm-hmm.
back a few years ago. And yeah, I mean, people can survive for a long time now with AIDS when that was totally different back in like the 80s. I remember, I was born in 1980, so just
mm-hmm.
a little bit of memories on the news from, you know,
mm-hmm.
when the AIDS crisis started. But did you lose a lot of friends back then?
Oh, mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah.
You literally were going to a memorial service every week at one point.
Oh,
you know,
man.
So-and-so has it, so-and-so's ex, da-da-da-da-da, this one and that one.
Yeah.
I remember sang for a while with the Great Lakes Men's Chorus,
mm-hmm.
which was an all-male gay chorus. Founded about the time about the time of the larger chorus that sings now.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember the director, Keith, calling me one Sunday, and the other baritone was a guy named Michael, who was a teacher. And he said, "Michael's gone." And I said, "Tell me he got hit by a truck.
Mm.
Tell me he got run over by a car. Tell me his elbow slipped and went down his throat and strangled him. Don't tell me he died of AIDS." And
yeah.
all Keith did was cry.
Mm.
That emotional impact on you. And I've made a couple quilt squares.
Yeah.
And every time the quilt comes, I say, "I'm going to go down, but I really don't want to."
Yeah.
Because I don't want to see all the ones I don't know about.
Yeah. That's always an emotional thing to see.
Yeah. So that helped break down some of the socialization. some of the structure
mm-hmm.
of the society that we had created. And we created that society almost in secret. My Masonic brothers might get upset, but we were almost like the Masons in the way that we recruit.
Yeah.
You know, is you're just around somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And you observe and you mentor and that kind of thing.
Gotcha.
But you never formally apply.
Right. Huh. Interesting. And I guess that still, yeah, depending on where you are, that still seems to be the mode of how things, you know, are operating, depending on, like, if you're in the UP or something, you know, it's a lot more underground, mm-hmm. gay communities in those types of places. But how, I guess, how have you seen that change in, well, I don't know if that's a good question. For things seem to be a lot more open nowadays. Mm-hmm.
I was watching TV the other day and I thought, I know things have changed because, who was the actor? Jesse Tyler, what's his name?
Mm-hmm.
From Modern Family.
Oh, yeah.
Jesse Tyler Ferguson.
There you go. That's.
And he was on The View, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, someone asked him about, he's adopted a couple children, evidently. And he said, yes, my husband and I. And I thought, it's really changed when a male can sit there and talk about his husband.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody batted an eye.
Right.
Nobody challenged him. It was just like it was the most normal thing.
Yeah.
And talk about two men adopting children.
Right. I mean, yeah, who would have thought even, well, I mean, 2004 was when all the gay marriage bans went through, like 20-some states, you know? Yeah. And going from that to now... Yeah. Is a pretty dramatic shift, which
I know probably more married gay men. You know, in my youth,
mm-hmm.
they were really married to women.
Oh, right.
You know, almost every gay man I knew had children because they had stifled their sexuality and they'd done the home and wife
right.
kids for as long as they could and then left. Now it's guys who've been together 20, 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty impressive. I guess it was just last year that the gay marriage ruling came down from the Supreme Court, mm-hmm. right? How did you feel about that, seeing that actually become a nationwide thing?
I'm ambivalent.
Yeah.
One of the few ambivalent. Because it's kind of a, you like it or you don't kind of thing, but I try and come down in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that we gave the conservatives and the conservative Christians enough ammunition to blow our fannies off. Referring to each other as husband and wife,
mm-hmm.
those words are so freighted with stuff, culture stuff, and mm-hmm. marriage being more about politics and guarding sexuality and
mm-hmm. you know,
hiding women's sexuality. So I don't really know. I know the people I know are happy,
mm-hmm.
and I understand. I've been single for many, many years. So I've never had a situation where I needed someone to be in my insurance,
mm-hmm.
or me to be in somebody else's insurance, or have access to an estate, or that's all foreign to me.
Sure.
Because in the relationships I had, we didn't do those things.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't even clear then on what term you were supposed to use. You say lover, you say partner,
right?
Friend,
mm-hmm.
special friend. You know, it just. Kind of strange.
Hmm. That's interesting. Do you think society is kind of like co-opting or taking over relationships? As you know, like when by allowing marriage now, it's like society's probably telling gay men and women that they should be married now, as opposed to the way things were before, you know, where...
I think some people, the conservative bunch, are still stuck back then.
Mm.
That's what they can see.
Yeah.
They can't see the reality. They don't deal with reality real well anyway, you know.
That seems to be true.
Like, the president-elect.
Yeah.
You'll never hear me call him President Trump.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that I think that was a...
The president, and I respect the office. I don't even go with the man who's in it.
Mm-hmm.
But that was one of the strangest elections I've ever witnessed. And I'm 65.
Yeah.
And I just...
Yeah, what, I mean, how have you felt about this, the whole, I guess, year and a half campaign and everything? Do you see society kind of going backward on
things?
I can
see a lot of them trying.
Yeah.
They're, excuse me, trying already. Because all the gay marriage rights and all that can go just as fast as they came.
True.
And we have to really be diligent because this guy's a screwball.
I guess it's hard to tell what he really thinks, at least Trump. The vice president-elect is...
He's an outrageous homophobe.
Ooh, yes. I don't think any of his views are hidden on that. So that, I don't know, that kind of worries me, I think, more than Trump himself does. But...
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, in my day, we would be at a party having this discussion.
Right?
Yeah.
Just, I like your image of the salons in France as the... That seems very descriptive.
Yeah.
And, yeah...
Yeah. How did we lose that sense of... Well, a lot of people died off, is what happened.
Yeah.
And there was no one to take the younger people and introduce them. It's like I said, expectations were higher.
Yeah.
They had a standard to meet, in a way.
Interesting. Yeah, some things, it's too bad that they've been lost over the years.
Yeah.
Technology seems to have changed a lot of
technology is really...
Mm-hmm.
I'm no fan of technology, as you would have seen this week with this printer.
Yeah.
Oh, jeez. I went to bought it at Microtech, 14 and I-75.
Oh, yeah.
In a week and a half, I was back in that store at least twice a day.
Oh.
Trying to get this thing to print. And finally, the guy who got it to print did it in 5 minutes. I don't know what he did.
It's always a mystery to me, too, when things like that go wrong, and then someone just, you need to hit this. Like, oh, great. But do you think that the technology has made relationships less personal now?
Yes.
Which is...
I do.
Yeah.
I've tried the dating sites.
Yeah.
No, I don't know. I've seen wedding announcements where people have met over one of those sites, and I don't know how they do it. Because I sure have never had any luck.
Interesting. Yeah, it's a brand new world, I guess. Goodness. All right. Let's see. Actually. Yeah, do you have any, concerns for the future with the gay community in the city, or just in general?
Yeah, I think a lot of them have given up on the city and don't really believe that this expansion and renovation is going to last.
Yeah.
And Detroit does have a history of kicking itself in its own ass. Yeah, we're very good at that.
Yep.
Very good. And the corruption atmosphere, I don't think it's totally gone.
Mm.
No.
Yeah.
But, yeah, there's they're starting to go even farther north than here. And they've been looking for a new church for MCC. And there is the Fifth Church of Christ Scientists, which would be an ideal size. Owned by the congregation in Detroit Unity across the street. And they're willing to sell and sell at a good price, but the congregation won't go back in the city.
Yeah.
We'd be going back to our community. But they're still scared.
Why do you think that is?
I think it's a... Even if they weren't gay, I think they would be afraid. Because so much has changed. The whole Kwame thing and the police department scandals. I would go home and tell my friends these stories, and they'd go, your police chief has an affair with a subordinate officer, and they both quit, and then she has an affair with his replacement. And I'd say, I'm not making this up. I'm a writer, I'm creative, but I'm not making this up.
Sometimes the truth is stranger than fiction, I guess.
Yeah. And Coleman Young did a good bit to keep a lot of people are still in that mind frame. Because he was just so anti-suburban.
Gotcha. So with the community in the city and I guess the greater metro area now, what contributions would you say that the LGBT community has made to this region or the city that maybe people don't know about or might have been overlooked, you know?
Well, I think a lot of the... just coming to Ferndale and opening businesses, and you don't necessarily know that it's a gay-owned business. But there's a lot of that. And businesses being willing to say, we'll cater to gay. I always say gay people, meaning both lesbians, gays.
Sure.
And that I can't. It's an old habit, you know.
Yeah.
If gay means attraction to the person of the same sex, then if you're two women, you're gay.
Sure. Okay. Yeah.
Lesbian as being separate. But I recognize there's transsexuals and transvestites and bi. I've never met very many bi people.
Yeah. That's... Yeah, there's so many different categories.
Yeah. I know. It's but... the one I heard recently. That I can't remember what they call it, but it was the idea that you were neither sex.
Oh, shoot. I know what you're talking about now. I can't think of the term either. It's a, there's so many. There's, well, and then there's asexual and intersexed and, like, yeah, I can't remember the other one. Oh, well. But, yeah. So, any advice that you have for people in the future?
I think we need to support places like Affirmations more. I mean, I don't support it that much. I just, their programming is not what I usually need. Though I hear there's a senior group that I may take a look at.
Gotcha.
But it's to maintain our unity. We have to somehow get some sense of unity. Behind us. We had physical unity there in the park, and that gave us a social center for us in the, but then again you have technology wearing its evil head.
True.
And the internet is great. I did all the transactions for my first book by internet. Submission to the author, the editor, the course, all the research and all that, it was all done via the internet. And now the publisher I'm dealing with for the second book is in London.
Oh, wow.
So we do everything by email.
Sure. Yeah, then, I mean, I guess it makes life easier for in that way.
Yeah, but it's there's got to be a fundamental change. This election, I think, pointed out to me that there were a lot of people just sitting there waiting to be aggrieved.
Mm.
And feeling that their grievances were somehow special over others.
Sure.
And that's sometimes true. But I think we need to get over the labels. You shouldn't have to sit and figure out if you're intersexed or bisexual or gay or whatever. You are you.
Mm-hmm.
And the sooner we get to that realization, you know. It's a funny place. I keep thinking about my childhood in Madison. I'm a child of the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So all that, with the University of Wisconsin there, of course, you had all that rioting. And the student marches, and I was in high school, and our teachers were not too much older than we were, and they still had friends who were marching, and so when we talked about history, we had much more sense of current history.
Sure.
And how that defines us, and how we got here. But that went for grade school, too. I remember in grade school, the Nixon-Kennedy campaign.
Mm.
And we were expected, even at a young age, we were barely 12, to read about the campaigns, to know what the two campaigners stood for,
mm-hmm.
watch the returns coming in, and discuss it in class.
Interesting.
And that was the parochial curriculum, and if sister said do it, you did it.
You know, right.
We need a few more of those ladies around.
Right.
But there needs to be some kind of central point, some that's seen by the whole community. That, in my day, was everybody knew that community.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody knew the bars, everybody knew the character of the places. If I can't see you except by email, you only get what I'm telling you, mm-hmm. which may or may not be the truth. Yeah.
True. So physical proximity, you think, is an important factor?
I think it's very important. And Ferndale has achieved some of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it's there the way it... And maybe it never will be. Maybe it's waiting for my generation to take off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and my generation's getting old.
Yeah, well, we all are getting older every day, I guess, right?
You're what, 12?
36.
36?
Yeah, so...
36 was 1988.
Oh, okay.
Was it? 36?
That might be... what year were you born again?
51.
51. So... Yeah, 87?
Or 87.
87.
Yeah, either I had just started my master's degree.
Huh. Goodness. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I remember recently talking to some kids who were in their teens, in early 20s, and they were grousing about gas prices. And I said, when I learned to drive in 67. When I learned to drive in 1967, which is the first thing that freaked them out, I remember paying 19 cents a gallon.
Wow.
For leaded gas.
Yeah.
In those big cars.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then sometimes stations would have price wars. Then they'd get down to a dime a gallon.
Wow.
And that was, but I said I was working, when I got my first job, I was washing dishes in the kitchen of a very classy hotel in Madison called the Edgewater. Beautiful white concrete stucco building right on the lake. I mean, right on the lake. It was the lake. It was right there. And I started at $1.10 an hour.
Wow.
And they all said, well, we never worked for that. We can't. You can't pay people. I said, this was 1967. That was the law.
Yeah.
And people raised families on those wages.
That's interesting. Well, yeah, I mean, if it's 19 cents a gallon, you can give it 5 gallons of gas on a an hour's wage. Now, I mean, that'd be more than $10 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, yeah, that's...
But you could get a hamburger and an order of fries and something to drink for 35 cents.
Wow. That's...
You know, an expensive meal in a restaurant
mm-hmm.
was $10 or $15.
Wow.
And that was a meal.
Mm-hmm.
And Ted's was great. Ted's was your diner where everybody knew your name. It was kind of like Cheers.
Oh, yeah?
You know, and nice. The waitresses, like, flow with the big...
The beehive.
Beehives. And the ex-Navy guy who was the cook. And like I said, the people, you go in there for Ted's special dinners.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when we get everything from soup to nuts, literally,
uh-huh.
and pay $5.
Wow.
Sometimes less.
Nice.
In the spring, the owner would go smelt fishing. So he'd bring back smelt, and they, since he caught him, he had no middleman cost, so it was like $3 for a smelt dinner.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Huh. Wow. Yeah, interesting. I guess I'm just thinking back to your, when you're talking about school, it seemed like having the kids learn about the campaigns and where a candidate stood and all that, it's a lot more civic-minded than people seem to be today.
Yeah.
Which is...
And it was required.
Yeah.
It just simply was expected.
Hmm.
Yeah. And it was expected that a certain number of you would go on to college and that some others of you would go into vocational training.
Mm-hmm. Huh.
It was just... And they knew who they those students were, and they treated them accordingly.
Interesting.
And the slowest kid in the Catholic school would be the average kid in the public school.
Huh. Interesting.
But I think it all comes down to dedication, in a way, dedicated to the community.
Mm-hmm.
And people often ask me why I got involved in historic preservation, and I tell them the story of the neighborhood in Madison where I grew up, or at least the first 10 years of my life.
Mm-hmm.
It was at South Park and Regent Streets near the university. It was called the Bush.
Mm.
It was the Italian and immigrant neighborhood.
Yeah.
And the city of Madison thought it was a slum and tore it down, demolished everything. And then turned out that the guy who was in charge of the program was setting it up so that his friends could buy the land cheaply, and they were going to then build luxury housing, which they never did. And the land stayed empty for many, many years before this came out.
Interesting.
And one of the people he evidently talked about cheating, we figured out later, was my grandfather. So the destruction of that community made a sharp impression on me even as a 10-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I got to the park, I thought, this is a beautiful place. This is a different place. This is a place that must survive.
Mm-hmm.
If there's anything I can do. And they did the historic designation and all that other stuff. And it's preserved. It's saved. Through a lot of hard work for an expense for other people.
Sure.
But... You know, I put in my 2 cents.
That's great.
And I think they're in the wheel of time, we may return to someplace like that again. Slightly different.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I just look back at those times and think, it was so different.
Yeah.
So different. Well, hell, I was 23 years old.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, viewpoints, or just, things change over that time.
I was working, one of my first jobs out of college was working for Central Transport, which is Matty Maroon, his operation, and they had a terminal at 6 Mile and Conant, and I made $2.25 a week, excuse me, that was $200 cash take home a week. Wow.
Not too bad.
And I was dumb enough to give it up.
Oh.
Because I couldn't stand. Working in a trucking terminal is a strange business.
Is it?
Yeah, they're all weird. They're all strange.
Interesting. Wonder why that is.
Well, it's such a... It's like being a cop or being a construction worker. It's such a demanding thing.
Yeah.
And in those days, truck drivers were not really paid very well. And they were working hard to keep both ends together.
Interesting.
And it was considered, like construction workers, it was considered a blue collar, not really worth it. Stupid. I remember getting into an argument with somebody on an elevator, and they were talking about stupid workmen and doing something for them. I said, you know, we better hope that the person who built this elevator was not stupid.
Right. Put a lot of trust in someone that puts elevators together. Interesting. Well, it looks like we're almost at 2 o'clock now. Any final thoughts?
No, I'm just glad that Ruther's doing this.
Yeah.
With my research, I spent some time in the Ruther. Probably should spend a little more time, but it was an interesting flock of stuff. Between the Burton and the Ruther, I had a lot of good information, and then there's more. There's still stuff I have not explored.
Oh, sure. There's so much out there. Well, thank you for this. I'm going to shut off the recorder now, so since we're toward the end, but we definitely appreciate you talking to us. All right. Thank you.